Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I want to send a big welcome to our newest business members, Jonathan and Amelia Sawyer, from the Greenhouse Tavern in Cleveland, Ohio. For more information on the Greenhouse Tavern, visit www.greenhousetavern.com.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's Restaurant, and I have a really special guest here with me today. But before I introduce him, I just want to do a huge shout-out. I know a lot of people are listening, professional cooks in the kitchens getting ready for service. So a huge shout-out to all of you, and I'm really happy you're with us today. Well, today I have a really special chef, a good friend, and someone I admire tremendously. And I will say up front, I put my money where my mouth is because, you know, I live in New York City. You know, people say, what's your favorite restaurant? And I should say L'Ecole, which is the school, International Culinary Center's restaurant. And I do love L'Ecole, but I live on the Upper West Side. And people say, well, where do you eat? And I have to say, I eat at Telepan. It is my favorite restaurant. I'm there more than anywhere else in the city. And today it is a huge privilege to have the chef and owner, Bill Telepan, with us. And let me just tell you a little bit about Bill before we start doing a deep dive into his life. You know, he, not so many years ago, but years ago, he was like the hottest chef in New York. He got 3 stars for this wonderful restaurant, Judson Grill, from the New York Times. And he was doing super American food when it wasn't as popular, let's say, as it is today. And then in December of 2005, he opened, I think, one of the best sole proprietor restaurants, personal, tremendous food, great size. And when he opened it, not only did I think it, but Zagat gave it the best restaurant the next year. And he's gotten best brunch. It is the ultimate New York City, if you live there, restaurant. And if you live in New York City and you haven't been there, you have to go. And if you're just visiting, we'll let you in too. So welcome, Bill.
Hi, Dorothy. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my gosh. You know,
we both live on the Upper West Side. We traveled far to Bushwick, but I'm glad we're here because I never get out here as much. So
I know, and you know what? You don't make pizzas like this.
No, no. You know?
It's how I get the chefs out here.
That's true.
Anyway, we're going to talk about the restaurant a little later in the program. But you are a local boy, are you now?
I grew up in New Jersey in a town called Sayreville, the boyhood home of John Bon Jovi, and they used to have a sign up in the line.
Wait a minute, didn't you get the War Memorial High School Hall of Fame?
Is he in it too? He's not. I don't know why. I think he didn't get the memo. But yes, I was inducted a couple years ago to my High School Hall of Fame, which was kind of fun because it was at like a VFW hall. I had some friends there from that area, and my family was there, so it was a fun night. So
and when you see Bon Jovi, you can go na 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 na.
Yeah, I can. I got one up on him. So
okay, all right. So
and then from and went to high school, but during high school worked in kitchens. So as a job to get a car and sort of hang out money and save money for college. So
was it just because the job was there, or did you have some predilection for food?
Growing up in my house, you know, my mom and dad were the hardest working people I know. And but they always, you know, mom would always cook us dinner. So
what did they do?
My mom, she was a cleaning lady for a while and worked in a bank that she used to clean after a while. And then my father worked the assembly line at a General Motors plant, all sort of in the area. So like when one was shut down, he would go to another one. So he had quite a hard life in his early 60s working the line. So he retired. you know, after 30 years, you get your sort of retirement package from General Motors, and which we're lucky that is still there.
Yes.
But he retired 30 years to the day, and got out. So and continued working, but so it wasn't sophisticated food.
So what was their dream? I mean, that's amazing. They must have been so proud with your 3 stars in the New York Times. What was their dream when you were young? What did they want you to
become? You know, I just think they were busy, and it wasn't anything. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be either a guitar player or a baseball player. And so it was just a matter. They wanted us to graduate and go on to college, obviously, or do something, like continue to do something well. And, you know, when people talk about success, I mean, if you think of, they're two of the most successful people. They raised 4 kids who are healthy, who are, you know, are not in jail, who fortunately doesn't have any issues. I mean, we're a pretty normal family, you know, knock on wood, except for my older brother. But they've succeeded in that respect. You know, they've worked really hard. They've raised children. And now they have grandchildren.
They're the backbone of America.
They're the epitome of America.
Yes.
And I think, when I graduated high school, I initially was going to go for engineering. I did very well in math as a kid. And then, I was going to a local community college to start, and that process. And I would drive past the restaurant I worked at. Now, it wasn't a great thing. It was this place called Garfunkel's, but which was sort of like a spinoff of like Houlihan's or, you know, Ground Round type thing. But it was independently owned. And it was run by 2 CIA graduates, the general manager and the chef. And so I worked there and did pretty well after having worked at another Italian restaurant for a year throughout high school. So I've
In what capacity were you working? Were you in the kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, after baseball season ended in 10th grade, I played for the team, in our high school team, and then I got a job through a friend of mine as a dishwasher. Actually, I should go back before that. Before the baseball season, I was working at a deli, making hamburgers and sandwiches and, you know, running the counter and giving out quarters for video games, and then played baseball and then got this dishwashing job. And then there was an opportunity at the restaurant. It was an Italian restaurant owned by a Greek family, a really wonderful family. And an opportunity came up for someone to work in the salads. And I said, hey, I used to cook because I hated dishwashing. So I worked 2 days as a dishwasher, 2 days as a cook. And then when tragically someone died in the kitchen and they needed the full-time cook. So I started working full-time the end of my junior year into my senior year and worked at that restaurant for about a year. And the funny thing is my friend who got me the dishwashing job was in the restaurant at Telefan the other day. And he was just like, you know, if I raised my hand, I would be in your position. I was like, me, I don't know.
I don't know either. You got a special talent.
So that's when I was like, let me go to, they pushed me to go to culinary school in the CIA since they graduated. So I said, okay. And I just dropped out of college, told my parents I was going to do this, which they were a little hesitant about. But, you know, they were like, hey, let's see what happens.
Wait a minute. Engineer or chef? I mean, that was those days was chef.
Yeah,
as
but
big
I wasn't.
As it is now,
yeah, I didn't get off to a right start at school. That so much. It was a little more difficult, like handling it. Anyway, so
okay.
I would have done fine.
We're
if
not going to talk about the party.
We're not going to talk. No. It's not. It wasn't. Yeah. All right. Whatever. And then so we decided. And I loved being in the kitchen. We had such a great time. You know, there was a point after I decided to do it. You know, we were looking through cookbooks and developing recipes. I mean, they weren't great or anything like that. But it was just the fun and the joy of creating something, and it was yourself. And it was a local place, so I knew a lot of people there. And I wasn't the chef or anything, but we were all really hands on and participate. You know, I butchered. I did all these things that, you know, when I got to school finally, and you know, I was so ahead of people. You know, just because. A lot of them never butchered a leg of veal. And so I showed off in front of everybody and how I could butcher a leg of veal.
This is up at the CIA.
This is up at CIA.
Yeah.
And so it really, it just sort of happened. You know, like people say, were you in, no, I wasn't at my mother's leg or my grandmother's leg, you know, making things. And we enjoyed to eat and we knew the importance of the food that was on the table. Because, you know, we were, you know, my parents, like I said, they worked hard in factories or whatever. So and there was a family of 6 of us. So we... You know, it's just kind of like, you know, I went to school and I befriended one of the chefs who gave me Charlie Palmer's name, who, you know, after graduation, I'm standing in the River Cafe trailing at, you know, and like I knew I wanted to be in New York. I just knew I needed to be in New York. And then through Charlie Palmer, I got the job with Alfred Portelli at right out of school at Gotham Bar and Grill, and which was, you know, as you know, and it's an incredible training ground for working in New York City.
Well,
high
first
profile.
Of all, the River Cafe, if people aren't from New York, the River Cafe is under the Brooklyn Bridge with the most spectacular views of Manhattan. Yeah. It's one of the sexiest, most ultimate, elegant restaurants in New York City. And for a kid to find themselves
there. Well, and back
there,
in the 80s,
really.
You know, there was a, you know, Charlie Palmer, not to yes. say anything, they're doing a good job now, but Charlie Palmer was the chef at the time I was there. And
really?
David
hot.
Burke afterwards. I mean, so all hot. These incredible chefs yeah. worked through there. So yeah. at the time, too, it was really not only, like you said, it's a magnificent place, but you had, it was a place to go learn to cook. And so it was really, it was an exciting time in New York at the time. It was like the, you know, it was mid-80s and great food movement from California. You know, Jonathan Waxman came over here, was working here. The whole, you know, Alice Waters was going up, was happening. I mean, the thing that happened at that time, it was about getting the best looking food, you know? Even though like Alice Waters had her local movement, in New York it was about the best looking. So we'd get those beautiful, I just remember getting those beautiful peppers from California or all, you know, all these perfect artichokes. I mean, they weren't, it wasn't really local then. And so it was great because at the time, it was starting to happen here in New York. And so I was, got to see that.
Were there farmers markets?
There were, I mean, the Green Market, it had existed. And David Boulay and you know, was, you know, one of those guys who was there all the time. And there were some chefs. But it was about, like, I went to go work with Alain Chappelle in France, which we'll talk about too. But it was like about that, little after that, like in the 90s, where the local movement started. I don't even know how we got there, but
no, because I think if there's something that defines you, and the reason I love your restaurant is because you truly reflect the bounty of the earth and seasonality and local, and it's your food is just so delicious, and it leverages off of local food. So let's get back to, so you're at the CIA at this point.
Yeah, so when I graduated, I went with Charlie Palmer to Trail, and it didn't work out. I don't know.
It didn't work out?
Well, I kind of stood around. I never had been on a trail in a real kitchen like that before. Okay. So, and then took this job down at the Seaport, and then got a call from Alfred Portelli because he needed a cook, and he got my resume from Charlie Palmer.
Now, wait a minute. If it didn't work out with Charlie, why was he palming you off to
Well, that's why I'm choosing to believe that it was that they didn't have a position.
Oh, okay. All right. That I believe.
So, and then worked with Alfred for 2.5 years to 3 years at that point, and after graduation. And it was vibrant. It was, you know, he had probably been there 2 or 3 years, so they had the 3 stars, a lot of attention, always busy. Lots of great people from the city and chefs coming in to check it out. I mean, he was, you know, yeah, it was 87 to 90 when I worked. Mm. It was just, you know, it's still an amazing, amazing, amazing restaurant. And that's the thing that I took out of it was if you want to learn how to produce a high volume of high quality food, this is the place to work. And that, it was just a magnificent training for me as a young cook. And then from there, you know, I was working with all these young American guys who were just really interested in cooking. They had all worked with all the great places in New York City and across the nation. And a lot of them went to France. And so one of my good friends at the restaurant, Bruce Beatty, who now runs a restaurant along the Hudson, he went to go to France. And Alfred had worked in France. Charlie Palmer worked in France. David Burke was winning the Millier d'Auvergne of the France at this time. And I was like, hey, you know what? Maybe that's what I should do. So I wrote 30 letters out to all the top restaurants. 20 of them didn't reply. 5 of them wanted me to pay them. 4 of them said no. And Alain Chappelle said, yeah, you can come work with me, but you have to stay for 2 years. And I was like, for no money. So I said, okay. And I figured I had a little money in the bank. I'd just go out there, wing it, and see how long I could stay. So, and that's kind of like where, like, I always tell everybody, like, what was the epiphany moment for you? So there's this moment when, you know, Chappelle would go into the Markets of Lyon and come back with his little Citroën truck and all the cooks would take stuff out. And it was early on when he brought this. I picked up a flat of strawberries and I put it down and they just kind of like shone up at me like, oh my God, look how beautiful they are. And I ate one. It was like brilliant. I kept eating them and I kept eating them. And I was like, next thing I know, 2 pints were gone. I was like, it's about the ingredient. Leeks would come. Just the humble leek would just be absolutely gorgeous. And then eventually, you know, you start noticing these things when you're working there. And, you know, farmers would come to the door with fist-sized black truffles and you know, chickens and rabbits and you know, the quality. And he would always emphasize, get the best ingredients you can get and just simply prepare it, or, you know, do what you have to do to make it really brilliant. And that was really, for me, like the start of like putting that in the back of your head. Because as a cook, you go work at places, and I believe you need to stay in it a long time, but you go work and you take the best out of what you learn and you sort of mash it together and go inside to your heart and your soul, and that will sort of come out and say, this is my cuisine, you know. And it's nothing new, you know what I mean, but it's all sort of like a mashup of everything, and you taste, and this is how, and how you think, it makes you think differently. And so I think at that point, from there on, I went to go work at Le Bernardin when Gilbert Lecoz and Eberhard Mueller were the chefs.
So when how long were you in France?
6 months.
6 months. And then you ran out of money.
And then I basically ran out of money at that point. So Chappelle, needless to say, wasn't too happy because I had agreed to stay for 2 years. I didn't sign anything. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So did you write a letter to Le Bernardin, or how did you get the job?
I threw a friend, and you know, I came back and I trailed at Boulay, and I, you know, went to Le Cirque and Le Bernardin, and you know, I knew I wanted to go continue that sort of, I went to the four-star places,
right.
And I was like, I got to work at the best places and continue to try to do that. And my friend Bruce, again, was working at Le Bernardin at the time. Again, another great time because it was high energy, great cooks in the kitchen. And, you know, he said, this, you know, like you go on trails, and like I trailed all night at Boulay where you do a 12-hour shift or something. So I go into the office and I meet Eberhard. He's like, so you're Billy, you're Bruce's friend? I said, yeah. He goes, and you came back from Chappelle? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, so when can you start? And so I was like, so it was like a 2-second interview, and then there
no,
I am.
When you had those French restaurants on your resume, that was the pass key, right?
Yeah, I mean, Chappelle really, I mean, you know, because you work, you know, it shows that you understand, you want to learn, you want to do well, I think. And I think, you know, now there's so many great restaurants in New York. I think, you know, when you have, you know, back in 87 when I graduated, you had, you know, Lutèce, you had Lydia, Philidia, you had Alfred, you had Charlie Palmer, you had 10 to 15 really good, great chefs who everybody wanted to work for in those restaurants. And take that over a 10-year period, there's got to be 10 really good cooks. So now you have 150 chefs who are really good, right? And, you know, this is 25 years ago. So now you have another 10 chefs who worked in the... So New York City, it's amazing. There's, you know, easily
here
500
are, right?
Really
yeah.
good restaurants.
Here
you know?
We are in Bushwick, and it's a 2-star Michelin.
Brooklyn,
anyway, we're
going
to have to break here. We're going to come back. And
I told you I had nothing to say.
I know. We're going to get into Telepam when we get back.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Bill Telepan from Telepan Restaurant on the Upper West Side. And as I mentioned before, one of my very favorite restaurants in the world and where you find me eating very often. So, Bill, we were just talking about getting back from France, doing your stages even in New York at Le Bernardin. But tell me about Telepan. You were at Judson. Well, when did you actually become a chef of a restaurant?
After Le Bernardin for a year, I went to go work with Danielle at Le Cirque for about 6 months, and then Alfred asked me to come back to be his executive.
Danielle Boulou was at Le Cirque at that time before he has his own restaurant.
So Alfred asked me to come back to be his sort of chef de cuisine, and I did that for 4 years. And then after that, I...
At
Gotham Bar Grill, sorry. And
you were getting stars there.
It was incredible. He still has like every 6 3-star reviews, so consistently, and just got one pretty recently. I got a call from somebody who worked with Danielle, who was opening a restaurant with a couple Upper West Side guys, and this was back in 96. So I was out of work helping Alfred with his cookbook, and I went to go interview with these guys, and it was to become what was known as Ansonia. Now, Ansonia was on the Upper West Side back in 96 before the real estate boom, so it was still considered like a deserted area for restaurants, and I had lived up there, and I knew that there was no place up there to eat. So it was kind of like a high-end, a little expensive for the area, and it was during the cigar sort of smoking craze, so the owners wanted to have a little cigar lounge upstairs after. It was supposed to be a cigar lounge upstairs afterwards, and we were going to do lunch and brunch, whole thing. It just turns out it was like we get this great review from Ruth Reichel in the New York Times, and we're mobbed. But we have the people who are spending $60-$70 per person for dinner, 10 feet away from the bar where some 25-year-old trader is smoking his cigar. So next thing you know, the trader didn't want to hang out with the older couple. The older couple didn't want to be with the cigar. So next thing you know, 3 months later, nobody was coming in. So we had to like revamp and it just never happened.
What a real restaurant story. That's a good example of how you have to think through your concept.
Totally. Or just follow through with the concept, the original concept. And try not to be you have to be true to yourself. And this is this is the restaurant, whether it's going to succeed or not, this is the restaurant I want to build. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, you can't all of a sudden be throwing, pizzas on the menu because that's what everybody wants to eat, and it's simple. I think, and I'll get to that a little because it's sort of like what happened during the recession with us at Telepan. So that was my first chef's job, and then after that closed, I helped did some consulting work, and then I knew the owners from Judson Grill, who were also the owners of Gotham Bar and Grill, and they asked me to talk to them about being the chef there. And I have always thought of Judson was a huge place, 220 seats. But how was I going to think about that farm that sort of cooking seasonally aspect in such a big midtown sprawling spot? Well, again, it was just one of those things where you just put your nose down and then make it happen and work it out and draw on all your experiences before. So we were really lucky. I brought in a great team who'd work with me, and we ended up getting 3 stars from Ruth Reichel in the Times a few months after I opened. And it was just a great success because it was midtown. It was exciting. It was busy. We did a great lunch there. We were the timing cafeteria. We, that big party space. It was just a huge, huge space. And we were able to make it work in a very small personal way because we were able to sort of look at each plate individually instead of looking at the big sort of big scale of it. It was really daunting, but we figured out how to make it work. So it was kind of it was a great experience in that time. And then they decided to make a change after I was there for 7 years. And that's, I was looking at for a couple years at that point to go off and do my own thing. I don't know, I always laugh about I want to do my own restaurant. It's like the most difficult thing you could do.
Well, every in the school, so many people want to go off and do their own restaurant. How many seats in Telepan?
With the bar, it's about 115, 120.
Okay. And it's like the ideal size in a neighborhood where you're doing your food. You had a sense of what it was like to open restaurants, but what was it like to open your own restaurant?
It's true. It's very like when we did Ansonia, I helped open that. So I just helped, work with them to design the kitchen and put the menu up, hired people, set up the sort of structure of the kitchen. Judson was sort of in place, but had to make it my own. But it was a working place. They did really well there. With Telepan, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, just finding... putting a business plan together. I mean, you go to school And there's no right way to do a business plan. Everybody, when I, after so many years of talking to people, how do they put, they try to get investors, or it's all a very different way. You just have to sort of, you know, do it. But
can
how
I
do
ask
you, learn
you how
that?
Much money you had to raise to open Telepan back
about,
in?
About almost $2 million. Yeah. Well, because the thing was, it was a restaurant that was.
This is 2005.
This is 2005. There was a restaurant that was 25 years old, Santa Fe. They're actually still going a couple blocks up, that needed a lot of work. And I obviously needed a bigger kitchen than they were producing. It was a Tex-Mex place. So I needed a little bigger kitchen. And you could come in, everyone's like, oh, let's go see where the magic happens. I'm like, all right, this is my tiny little box. and so we had to move the kitchen. And it's in two townhouses. It's in two townhouses, so we have two different addresses at the restaurant. We have two different certificate of occupancies. I didn't need to get two different liquor licenses, thankfully. So there's all that building department stuff to deal with, and how to put the fire gates into the decor, because you needed fire gates because it was two separate addresses.
Oh my gosh!
So it really needed to be stripped down and replaced. The floor in the bar area was all gone, so we had to lay a new floor down and stuff. So there was a lot of work, but you know, from the business, from the time you see the space to the time you put the business plan together to the time you raise the money to it, you know, it, I saw the first saw the space in June of 2004 and we opened in December of 2005. So there you go.
So who do you go to raise money from?
I went to people I knew, and I went to customers who I knew had a certain wealth and I who would eat there. And I was very lucky. I met my my partner at the restaurant, this man named Jimmy Nicholas, who was in the printing business. And I met Jimmy at Judson Grill when we used to do a fundraiser for the Green Market there. And one day the manager came up to me and said, you should go say hi to Mr. Nicholas on 23, because he was the guy who bought all the live auctions. And I said, okay. So we hit it off. We had a great sensibility. And there's a restaurant in Florence, Italy that I absolutely love, Cibreo. It's one of my favorite places to go. My wife and I had a great meal there. And I got to talking to Jimmy, and it turns out that it was his favorite restaurant also. And so he's a guy who was, 25 years, 30 years in the printing business on the sales and going out to eat 5 days a week. He knew more people. He knows more people in the business than I do, because he'd walk into the restaurant like, hey, Jimmy, how you doing? So, and it was great because he helped with a lot of the financing, and we just reached out to friends who wanted to be part of it. My daughter's doctor became part. It was just
happened. So all of you out there working in the kitchens who wants it, you know.
Get to know your customers.
Get to know your customers. So how did you come up with the concept? What did you know exactly what the menu was going to be like?
Well, what I did that I thought was differently is I love the Italian style of eating. So where they have the antipasta, the primi, and the secondi. And I love the idea that you can go into an Italian restaurant, you could get something from three courses, you get a salad and a pasta, you could start with a pasta and have a main course. I mean, I just loved it. And I knew I also wanted to feature more vegetables. So how do you work that in from the separate from the appetizer entree format? So, you look at they have this whole list of pastas, and we kind of decided that's what we're going to do, you know. I also really wanted to do a lot with eggs, because during the time before Judson closed and Telepan opened, I had a lot of time at home and cooked a lot and found this wonderful egg purveyor who I just wanted to figure out a way how we could feature. And you started seeing eggs pop up a little here and there on menus. And back in the day, Gotham used to have an omelet on their lunch menu. Le Cirque used to have an omelet on their lunch menu. So eggs would be, and you always think like, and I would make eggs for dinner all the time. So, and then from there we decided, so it was like, how do I take this Green Market style that I want to cook, be seasonal, but be able to sort of approach it this way, in an American way, you know? So in the beginning, it was kind of confusing to people because they're like, you're an American restaurant, what are mid-courses? Yes. I figured like if I could set it up, if I called it preemie, people would, oh, I get it. So when I explain it, that's how,
other thing is you have a great bar area, and to sit there, that menu is perfect.
Yes.
Like you come in, the whole neighborhood comes in and sits at that bar and eats.
Yeah, no, it's true. And that's something that takes time also. And I think when, I decided that's how I wanted to do it. and just work at it and stick to it. Because I knew people were going to go to Lincoln Center nearby who may want just a salad and a pasta. And we had a great wine. You know, Jimmy contributed a lot of wine. He's a wine collector, so contributed a lot of his wines. And we had a great wine director and still do have a new one, but he's really wonderful too. So we knew wine wanted to be focused. So we wanted to figure out, you're going to have the people come in for a salad and pasta, and you might have people who want to do a little bit of a tasting menu and spend some money on wine. So it became... I knew after the initial 2 years of the madness of people coming in to check you out the first time, I knew it was going to be a neighborhood, well, we call it a destination neighborhood restaurant. And part of it is because it's not an everyday neighborhood restaurant, but we do get a lot of clientele. So we really worked hard. And this is important too for young chefs to know, is that, you know, it's not just about what you're doing in the kitchen, it's what's happening outside and needing to know what's going on out there. So, you know, talking to someone like Tom Valente, who's who has West on the Upper West Side, and how to deal with the clientele up there. He was just like, make sure you have tables for the locals, because that's going to be your base. So, and sure enough, it was a, you know, we say in the beginning, we would save 25% of the bookings for local people, and after time they got to know that. So we, you know, we'll open and we'll do 25 to 40 more covers from what we open, just because it's 7:30, the person down the street says, you know what, we want to come in for a bite to eat, and we'll have a table for you in 20 minutes, come down, boom. And it happens all the time with us. So that's, you know, there's so many factors that create a success that we don't know as chefs in a kitchen, but you just got to pay attention. So, and that's, you know, back to the business plan is, you know, I'm one of the fortunate ones. I have a lovely wife who has a business degree from Columbia.
I see. Okay.
And I also have friends who have put business plans together. So it's a matter of asking questions and you know, everything's a learning process. And the only way you're going to learn is to either be curious or to and ask questions. And I think, you know, I'm, you know, my wife's been a great influence with on me that way. And I think that, you know, you have to be that way. And you have to sort of lift your head up.
How much of a business person are you in running the restaurant?
Oh, I know everything.
Okay.
I know
everything. And you have to know everything.
You have to know everything.
Or you can lose your shirt.
Yeah, and that was a good thing at Judson. They were, you know, I was very involved in, you know, I was involved in the profit sharing. So I was, and, you know, we had discussions about it. Even back when I was sous chef at Gotham, they had me involved in, you know, how to, you know, what makes it run? Like, what are the percentages to make it run? And so, and that's the trick. I mean, like, how do you know? Like, there's so many little factors. Insurance, you know, what is it called? Credit cards cost a year. I mean, those credit cards at my restaurant are hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know,
glad you're doing so well, Bill.
No, but it's the truth.
You want that to go up.
You want that to go up. Yes, I understand. But, you know, and how much, you know, balancing food costs, labor costs, and picking and choosing. It's like food costs is so important. You know, and you have to really understand it. It's not about like, you know, I'm going to put the best you have. Like, that's what with the green market cooking is, that, you know, we're able to sort of now where we buy 80% during the season locally. But that can be a little pricey. So how do you be smart about doing that? How do you pick and choose what is going to go in? So your
okay, hold on to that thought. We got to take a break. But I want to come back and talk about how expensive local seasonal produce is.
Okay. Or not.
Listening to Chef's Story on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Bill Telepan of Telepan's Restaurant up on West 69th Street off of Columbus on the Upper West Side, perfect for Lincoln Center or brunch if you're going to go into Central Park. It's just great. So we're just talking about how hard it is to run that little restaurant. So many people think, I'm a great cook. I've done dinner for 40. I can open a restaurant. And the business, we're not going to get into the business. It's too boring at the moment. But I want to, because your menu is exquisite, I have to say. And it's not just, you say Italian, it really is reflective of you. I love your potato pancakes. Right. I love your smoked trout, you know, with radicchio.
The one thing, like I talked about before, it's like when you become a chef, it's sort of a mash of everything. So mm-hmm. it's like when everyone tells me like, well, what is your cuisine? I always say, I'm a guy from Jersey who's parents had a garden and we ate a lot of blueberries, who works in a lot of French restaurants, spent time in France, loves Italian cooking. I'm Hungarian Slovak, so that influences me a lot. So all of that. And then you think about like what I like to eat. And so to mash that up with what, you know, where I think Mario Batali said it one time, he's like, I'm an Italian restaurant. I'm a Northeast USA Italian restaurant. So he bought, you know, and we're kind of like that. This is what we can get from the Northeast. And what's in season. And so that, it's so important
to
me.
How hard is it to get local produce like you do? Is it, you know, it's easier today, but still, how hard is it? How expensive is it for all of the people out there who really want to do a restaurant?
Well,
like
I mean, I think it's you have to really work hard at it. And we do. And fortunately, I've been doing it for a lot of time. So the hard work is, I don't want to say done, but it's easier for me now because I know a lot of people out there and buy from a lot of people. And there are many, many more people who are out there now. The green markets are wonderful now. There's more of them. I mean, we're probably sitting underneath the farm now, so people are growing their food more now. And so I think, you know, in terms of expense, it's one of those things where it may cost a little more, but it doesn't cost as much more as you think it is, especially for a restaurant. You know, I buy like, you know, I'll buy twice a week, you know, 16 bunches of carrots, say, from a local farmer. So I'm not going to pay retail, although some of them do charge you retail prices, you know. But again, it's like, the thing you gain in that, and people notice it, is flavor, you know. And it's like I said, there's many factors, environmental factors that are important, I think. But the fact that the carrot was pulled on Tuesday and you have it in your refrigerator on Wednesday is very important to me. And people notice it. I many customers have come up to me and they'll have just a simple vegetarian plate and say, oh my gosh, the cauliflower was so wonderful. And you could just taste the difference between. And I challenge people to go to a Gristiti's and buy a head of cauliflower and then go to the farmer's market that day and taste them side by side. There is a definite difference. And sometimes it's subtle, but there's a true difference in when you're cooking it too. And the other thing too is that you're buying it, you're getting that carrot in, and it can sit in your refrigerator longer because it hasn't sat in a refrigerator at you know, your big, you know, person who sends you the food, your big
or coming over from California.
Or coming over from California, right, exactly. So those things are, to me, are important, like the flavor. So in terms, you don't waste as much also, you know, because there's not a lot of bad lettuce, say. Your lettuce isn't going to go bad quicker. So if you have a slower night, it's going to be more shelf stable than a lettuce coming from California or from Mexico or so.
So in addition to, I mean, having a restaurant is 24/7. It's a lot of work, but you've managed in your time to carve out some time to do some charitable work.
And yes.
So why don't you tell us how you got into what you're doing right now, and tell people what you're doing.
Well, right now I'm the, I guess, unofficial or maybe official by now, executive chef of Wellness in the Schools, which is an organization in New York City where we help the school food people cook from scratch, take out process. Our goal is to eliminate processed food. We have many goals, but one of them is to eliminate processed food because we believe it's healthier for the child. There's a high obesity rate across the nation. We think that kids who get really good food will and also move around. There's also a coaching element to the program that they'll also have a better chance of learning the second half of the day. Because if they eat a lot of processed food, a lot of sugar sort of in that for that lunchtime period, they'll get tired and they just can't finish the day that well. So we believe that cooking you know, a scratch meal, non-processed, getting them running around in the recess yard will help them finish the day well. So
there's an exercise component.
Yes, coach for kids. So what we do in that aspect was we bring a coach to hang out in the recess yard. So it prevents bullying and also gets kids doing something. Like in my daughter's school, we were in it.
So this is how you got started. Your daughter's in the...
My daughter's in, it was at PS 87 on the Upper West Side, and touring, you know, there's the founder of Wellness School, Nancy Easton, and some of the moms in the school and the school food manager were putting out sandwiches that they wanted to feature at the school lunch line. They were healthy sandwiches, a tofu, Asian wrap, and some kind of chicken salad sandwich. It was all delicious. And my wife and I were going into the parent-teacher conference, and, you know, I knew them all. So I said, hey, how you doing? And I grabbed some sandwiches to eat them, and I was like, oh, these are pretty good. So I walked out, and I'm thinking, oh, finally, I don't have to make school lunch for my daughter. So I'm walking out. I said, how can I help? Because I figured I'm a chef, so I know how to cook. So I figured there's got to be ways to cook in the cafeteria, better food. And so not knowing what I know now, but I know, you know, I believe that there you can cook healthier food in the cafeteria. So I started by, you know, I would volunteer to do recess yard work, watching the kids, patrol.
Yeah.
So there in my LVS. One of the APs called me in and said, why don't you look at the salad bar here? So I looked at the salad bar, and they do, and now they have these wonderful salad bars all through New York, which Jorge Collazo, who's the executive chef of school food in New York, you know, has really been pushing.
I know, he was on the show here, and he really, you know, he's trying to get his best to do what you want there.
And so I saw it at that moment. I mean, it wasn't up to par what we thought could be a good salad bar. So I decided at that point, at PS 87, I would do a salad bar day, I would do a sandwich day featuring their sandwiches, and I would do a hot entree dish, which I didn't have at the time, but we ended up doing a vegetarian chili, which became the sort of staple, like our sort of like, here, you could do it, you know, dish.
Your flag dish. In the chili.
The flag in the chili dish. And so I did that. And so with the help of volunteers, there were some moms who helped volunteer, and we got permission from school food to do it. I did a salad bar day where they, you know, we just did, our salad bars feature some greens. It's romaine lettuce and spinach now. Three raw vegetables that we slice up, like cucumbers, carrots, peppers. One to two composed salads, like a chickpea salad, a healthy coleslaw, and then some homemade dressing. So now, I mean, we've got so many salad dressings. We've not only created, but I'll get it. How we did that was because we're in 40 schools, but over the years we decided that we want to, in the model of Teach for America, bring in cooks who are culinary graduates to help teach and work alongside school food people to help them learn how to cook. Because there's so many, I mean, the job of school food is so hard because they feed a million kids a day in 1,500 schools. Mm. It's hard to keep track of that. So our program goes in and helps and works alongside them to sort of give them the confidence, give them the training, and through osmosis sort of change the culture of the school. Because it's a lot about like, oh, let's just, the kids want to eat chicken fingers. Well, they may want to eat chicken fingers, but you know what? If you made a real chicken dish and made it tasty and knew how to do that.
But, you know, in defense of the board is introducing new, they're trying to do this too.
Oh, no, they're totally.
Yeah. So
they're,
you're doing this alongside where there's a lot of chefs involved. I know Zach Palacio is in a school. Yeah. Cesare Casella has done it. Jonathan Waxman. Yes. They all have kids in the public school. So what you're really advocating is where some of you chefs have kids in the schools, you're going in and you're trying to augment what the lunch people are trying to do, because they're frustrated too.
Oh yeah, no, and it's a sort of a it is in a way, and we do have a partnership where we work together and are trying to sort of, you know, like I said, they have a big job, and we're just trying to help them.
Now there are a lot more salad bars right in the schools that they've managed to get in with Whole Foods. Aren't they doing a deal with?
They're
Whole
doing
Foods?
Whole Foods is opening a big shop on 57th Street, so they're doing, in honor of that, they're doing a 57 salad bar donation to the school food, and so we're gonna work alongside school food to help with some of our people at Wellness in the schools to help make sure that, you know, to sort of help in the training element of the salad bar. So there's all these interweavings that we have with them that's sort of, which is great, and that's what it has to be. I mean, to sort of take it to the next level.
It's almost like the food PTA. You know, they have PTAs and they want parents' participation in the schools.
Well, this
is almost like the parent participation on the food level.
There is a parent coordinator in every school now that was brought on many years ago that wasn't there. So it was basically the person that the parents can go to then talk to the school. So it's kind of like one of the things we believe in is like, why can't we have that kitchen element also? And that's something we're kind of like, you know, so we have that cook in the kitchen who sort of works with the school food people, works with the parents, because our program succeeds when we have a manager who is who helps us out, who works for the
manager,
for
the manager, Board of Ed manager.
Board of Ed manager. We have a good cook who is interested in doing it. We have parents who are behind the program, and we have a principal who's behind the program. Those things, when those are all working, it works beautifully. You know, mm-hmm. So when you have, you know, once in a while you have some people who just, it's a matter of being busy. It's a matter of not like knowing it, and education is such a big part of it. We do a lot of that also. We go into the classrooms, and four times a year with these cooking labs, we call them, and we teach every kid in every in the schools that we're in. And so it's basically like basic cooking classes of food that they'll see in the cafeteria. So like when we do our bean lab, we're making the vegetarian chili. So all those kids that were like, there's no way I'm trying this. Well, they're making it now, and then they try it. And then next thing you know, they're in line getting the vegetarian chili. So education is such an important part of this too. Just because parents may not know like that what they're putting into their kid's body may end up being harmful. Nancy Easton always says, if chicken fingers killed you immediately, they'd be wiped out, but they don't. It takes time to kill.
So tell me, you went down, didn't you go to the White House for
Michelle Obama's? I was part of the there was 10 chefs, including Jorge, who were, or a dozen chefs who were involved, not just food school workers, but also chefs like myself, who were involved in helping put the chefs move the schools together. Mm-hmm. So we all brought our ideas, and they took the best practices out of it and developed this wonderful thing that was a call to chefs to get into schools, to grow gardens, to teach kids cooking classes, to help school food providers with the menu, all these things that that educate people. Kids get so excited. When I throw my chef's coat on, I'm telling them, signing fourth grade autographs.
Really? Really?
It's really wonderful. They're so into it. And I think,
do you think that's because of the cooking food channel?
Totally, totally, totally. I mean, because I'll get it. Were you on Top Chef? Have you ever been on food? You get all that stuff. They love it. And that's great. I mean, that's a wonderful thing. So they see that part of it, and so it's a matter of like, how do we get them to think about, like, they'll eat their French. Hey, listen, I like French fries and hamburgers too, But it's a matter of like,
have you noticed kids' palates changing at all? Because you've been doing this for a few years now.
It definitely. And that's the thing. It takes time. Like, you can't just sort of throw a sauteed cauliflower in front of a kid and expect them to eat it. Some may, but like my daughter took like a dozen times for us to put it on her plate. And until she finally tried it, now she loves it. And I think that's what's important about our what makes our program work, is that we're there every day with our cooks. And when I talk about culture change, that becomes important, because you need to sort of be there, and it has to be constant. You can't just all of a sudden say, oh, you know what? I'll put salad out today, and if they don't like it, I'm never going to put it out again. No, you have to keep at it and be persistent. And that's, I think, what makes our program successful, is because we know it takes time. We know you have to be persistent, but we know you don't have to sit there and bang a drum doing it. You just have to be very subtle and just work at it slowly. And I think, it takes time. It takes time. It just takes time.
So, vision for Telepan in the future, getting back to your restaurant?
Well, I'm looking to put out another cookbook. I put one out in 2004 called Inspired in Ingredients. And so I'm working on one that's called, loosely named the Telepan Family Cookbook, that will sort of capture cooking with your family, all the sort of dishes that inspired me to be while I was a chef, all the things I love to eat, all the things that I work with some amazing people at Telepan who've been with me for a long time, things that they love to cook or they have cooked for us, include that, and things my mother-in-law cooked, who was a great cook, things my mother cooked, and get to cooking and things that you could cook with the family. We're always looking. I'm always looking to do another spot. So we just keep our eyes open. But no rush.
Okay. Well, I hope you rush back to the restaurant and start cooking.
I'm going to eat a little pizza.
Yeah, really. We're going to eat some pizza here, but then we'll go. Well, thanks a lot for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me on.
And,
it's great to be here.
I'll be in soon. See you next time. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you've been listening to Chef Story.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.